This is Whitley Strieber, and this is Dreamland. You've reached the edge of the world.
Well, folks, welcome to the new Dreamland. Those of you who are watching are seeing me, Whitley Strieber, and Brooks Agnew. That's my wife, Anne, in the background. Brooks has got a lot of stuff in his background, and if you are still in the listener mode, that's fine. The whole show will be, as usual, available for listeners on all our podcast apps and so on and so forth. Brooks will be with us on Saturday, the 23rd of January, in our subscriber video room answering your questions. So do come to the subscriber video room on Saturday morning at 11 a.m. Pacific time. It should be a lot of fun. Brooks, I would like to welcome you to Dreamland as our first video guest. And we're going to be talking today about Brooks's book, Remembering the Future. I don't know if I should hold that up again, but we're just starting out with this. This is a new thing for us. We won't be holding up books again because obviously that did not work. But nevertheless, Remembering the Future. Before we start, Brooks, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and your work and how it is that you have come to where you are?
Well, I'm a professional engineer. I've been in the automotive and high-speed manufacturing business for 33 years now, and mostly consult with the Fortune 500 or thereabouts. Kind of shifts around who's in there. But in my studies of mathematics and engineering, I also have an esoteric side, which explores into things like consciousness and resonance and physics, and it interests me. So in 2007, I wrote this book called Remembering the Future, The Physics of the Soul and Time Travel. And it's kind of a shopping cart, but it tells a story of how human beings are sort of a biological transducer, for lack of a better description. We're a fine instrument in the universe, and we can not only receive, but we can also send. And so in my career, I have, of course, made a fascination out of using all kinds of sensors and controls and things like that in high-speed manufacturing. But I've also been fascinated at how quickly human beings can adapt to all kinds of situations, express themselves with what they do and what they say. And I decided to write this into a book because, as a scientist, I realized that we have a profound observation effect on everything around us, people and matter itself. And I thought, if we do that accidentally, I guess that's what the kind of society we have. But if we do it on purpose, we could have profound effects on the quality of life, not only for ourselves, but the universe itself. So the book is sort of a how-to book to improve yourself and to use these principles of the universe, resonance theory, and let's call it the law of attraction because it's a well-known term with your listeners, to manipulate the universe around you in a scientific way. And so it's an interesting book. It's been a top seller for a long, long time, and I still lecture on that book every year.
Yeah, and you've recently updated it. I'm looking at a 2019 edition.
Yeah, I've made three additions to it because there have been discoveries in the physics community that have been profound on, let's call it, the downward causation side. For a long time, we've been searching for a theory of everything, a theory that kind of blends quantum mechanics and gravity or macro mechanics together into one theory. We've come up empty-handed with brain theory and string theory and all kinds of dimensional ruminations. But recently, there was a discovery that we believe might be the root of what we call the golden mean, or the phi, or the golden ratio, which is a key to understanding resonance and application of small amounts of energy in a resonant way. And so I made a third addition to the book and included Garrett Anthony Lisi's discovery of this about 2.5 years ago.
Now, when you say resonance and the golden mean, you know, you're, of course, we're all wondering, what does he mean? Speaking of means.
Well, you know, in the universe from absolute zero to X-rays, it's full of all kinds of energy, and it's rattling around like broken glass in the universe. And yet we do see that energy organize itself into matter, into stars and planets and molecules. But for as far as we can see in the universe, and as small or even to the furthest stretches of the universe, we only really see two particles. We see protons and we see electrons. And we have analyzed these protons by smashing the little beggars apart at nearly the speed of light. And we think we have a pretty good menu of what makes them up. But even though we know what goes in them, we can't seem to go from energy to matter. We can't, with all of our knowledge and all of our computer programs and measurements, we can't sing the right song, as it were, to make a proton. So that fascinates us, that energy can somehow violate the second law of thermodynamics and form or organize into matter. And so when we talk about the golden mean, we talk about this ratio of 1.618 to 1. It is an instantaneous rate of change that allows energy to form matter. And that's what we're trying to understand.
Free Dreamlanders, we're going to be taking a break now. Those of you who are watching on YouTube will not see the break. So what I'm going to do now is, this will not always be the case. Soon, when we get this set up correctly, there will be a regular break. In any case, I want to remind you that my Jesus, A New Vision is available on Amazon as a Kindle and will soon be available in all other forms, including audiobook, hardcover, and softcover. Brooks's website is brooksagnew.com, and he's got a wonderful store on his website. You can see all of his books there and explore them, including Remember the Future, which is the one we're primarily talking about today. Obviously, a fascinating life and a fascinating mind. Now, Brooks, I would like to ask you this question about the way things are organized. We cannot make a single proton. We've never been able to do it.
It's true.
Now, do you have any? Can you enlighten us as to why not? What is the missing part there that we can't put in?
That's a great question. And even big, expensive labs like CERN, which is a super collider in Geneva, Switzerland, we're trying to answer that very question. Of course, we're doing it sort of like breaking things apart to see what makes it work.
Yeah, that's my impression. You know, yeah, you don't know how the radio works, so you take a hammer and hammer it until it's broken into pieces. And then that doesn't help, so you do it again and again and again. Is that sort of the process?
Well, sort of. But what we, in smashing the radio apart, what you realize is that, you know, smashing the transistors and diodes and boards apart really doesn't tell you everything you need to know. What you need to know is, how are those things connected together? And what purpose do they serve in the circuit itself? So when we talk about all the muons or the subatomic particles it takes to make up a proton, the first thing we realize is that not all protons are created the same. For instance, hydrogen protons, which are the ones that we smash apart in the supercollider, they're the heaviest of all the protons. They're just by themselves in space, one proton floating around with one electron around it, or sometimes two. Helium is two protons, all right? So the interesting thing is that helium protons are slightly different than hydrogen protons, not in the composition, but in the weight. Helium protons are lighter than hydrogen protons, and they continue to lose weight all the way down to iron on the periodic chart, and then they slowly begin to gain weight as you go out to the periodic chart. So what we now know is that protons are actually a hologram. They're actually all of those components, but they're put together in a certain way to make that proton a what we call strong molecular force. It's not coming apart. that hydrogen proton doesn't get stale and old and dry out or wither. It's forever. It stays together forever. And the reason it does is because of that resonance of those subatomic particles that keep it together. That totally violates the second law of thermodynamics. It's very Hamiltonian in the way that that thing stays together. We're trying to understand that, but that's only half the struggle. I chose the other half of the struggle, which is let's assume that they stay together like that, and then let's see what we can do to manipulate it or emulate it in our own lives. And that's where the great discovery happened. That's why I wrote the book.
Well, okay. That tempts me to ask a pretty obvious question. What is the discovery?
Like, there are people that wrote books about the law of attraction. So they said, you know, take a pair of scissors and find the favorite thing that you like and cut it out and put it on your refrigerator. And then every time you go to your refrigerator, look at that motorcycle or that house or that truck or whatever it is you want to buy. Every time you go to the refrigerator and before long, you'll have it. In a way, that was part of it because you're making a tone. You're making a frequency out there in the future somewhere that's the same over and over and over again, like hitting a tuning fork. Where they were missing the secret to the secret is that that frequency goes out in all directions throughout all time in eternity. And other things around us sympathetically resonate with that frequency. It's sort of like if you had an acoustic guitar. I don't know if you play music, but if you have an acoustic guitar and you put it outside of its case, say against the wall, and then you turn your stereo up really loud with music on it, somewhere in that music, one of the strings on that guitar will sound like somebody just plucked it with a pick. In reality, what's happening is the string is absorbing energy from the music in the room and is re-resonating its own sound. We call it an absorbance frequency or an absorption peak. And if you could measure it, which we can, by the way, you could see how much energy the guitar is pulling out of the room full of music. So that's what we decided to do. In the mathematics, we you know what the Fibonacci sequence is, right?
Oh, yes. But let our listeners know, because not everybody does, I would suspect. But well, keep it fairly simple.
A long time ago, mathematicians and philosophers were kind of straddled the fence. And in those days, a philosopher whose name, or a mathematician whose name was Leonardo de Pisa, he was nicknamed Fibonacci. He had this idea that turned out to be a true principle in mathematics, that if you start at zero and you add one to zero, you get one. And now you have this three-number sequence, zero, one, and one. So if you take the last two numbers and add them together, one plus one, you get two. And slowly this number begins to increase in the rate that it's increasing until it gets to 1.618. It stops. It doesn't matter if you go to infinity, it will stay on that rate of increase.
Right.
It explains how pine cones and conch shells and bacteria growth and planets lay around suns and the periodic charts laid out. All these principles that we can see, what we call empirical data, began to fit along this instantaneous rate of change. It was remarkable. So I was teaching my college algebra class one day, and I had some adults in the class, and I wanted to make that mathematics a little bit more memorable, because I thought, oh, you know, they'll take the test and answer the two questions on Fibonacci, and they'll never use it again as long as they live. So I got on my calculator and I just asked a simple question. What happens if we don't start at zero? Let's just take two numbers randomly out of space. So I picked two numbers. One was odd. One was even. They weren't divisible into one another. They didn't know each other. I added the two numbers together to get the third. There's my first three numbers in the sequence. I went eight iterations and darn if I didn't divide the seventh into the eighth and get 1.618 to one. And I thought, wow, that was really lucky. I should go buy a lottery ticket. but it worked every time I did it, no matter which numbers I chose. And it worked with decimals and fractions and irrational numbers and even linear equations.
So what were you looking at? What was going on there?
It is a phenomenon that we see in this called, let's just call it a Fibonacci process instead of Fibonacci numbers.
Yeah.
It is the way the universe terminates its rate of growth. And if you can get close to that line, what'll happen is in 8 iterations, it will begin to build its own strength, its own, you know, Jesus once said, if you have the faith of a mustard seed, you can say to the mountain, be thou removed, and it will move.
Right. That's what he was saying, was that there was so much incredible energy locked in the smallest thing.
It's true, but you know, we think, gosh, I can't take this mustard seed and flick it against that mountain and make it move. Well, no, but if you flick that mustard seed at that mountain at exactly the right moment over and over and over again, you will build up eventually a resonance in that form, and it will move that mountain because it will constructively interfere with itself.
You might be rather old when the mountain moved.
Yes,
I had quite a few mustard seeds.
It's a lot.
But you know something fascinating? I spent many years trading commodities. I'm not doing it now, because my wife Anne was my genius commodity advisor, and she's passed on. But now we're working together again in a lot of different ways, and I'm hoping I'll start to get some really good advice from her. In any case, one of the best tools out there, best indicators out there, is the Fibonacci sequence. If you know how to use it in trading, you can figure out when changes in direction of the market are likely to happen. And the thing that's strange about it, it works on every scale. In other words, if you're trading on a 1 minute scale or even a one tick scale, it works. If you're trading on an hour scale, it works. If you're trading on a daily scale, it works there too. It is completely interconnected, and it's fascinating. But it doesn't always work. It's not perfect. Nothing is in trading, because there's all kinds of people out there with all kinds of ideas, and it's so complex. But Fibonacci gives you enough information to where you can be trading it maybe 7 out of 10 trades successful, which will make you rich if you keep at it.
Yeah, and of course, it doesn't take much of a genius to figure out that if this will work with numbers and this will work with trading, it will also work with energy. And I made an assumption in the book that we are actually a source of conscious energy, because we have desire, we have will, we can do things on purpose. We could perceive time, which, as far as I know, we're the only sentient beings on Earth that can perceive time.
I think so. I think you're right. We also the only creatures on Earth that can move our attention.
Yeah,
we're remarkable creatures.
Tomorrow, it doesn't work.
No,
and tomorrow.
But we're going to take another brief break, folks. And I hope that in the future these breaks will be smoother. Just a minute. And everything will be smoother. We'll have a producer on board, and we don't have that today. This is just an initial run, but it's going to be good for Brooks, because I'm sure your show is going to get a lot of attention, because it's a Dreamland's first video performance in since the show started, since 1998.
Wow.
So this will be a first. Now, so
first in my class, alphabetically.
What I want to say during the break this time is to free Dreamlanders, do subscribe to unknowncountry.com. We need you, and it is well worth it. The show, the Dreamland alone, goes back to 2004. There's an immense richness on this website. Immense. It's nothing like it in the world. It's also a kind of a safe space because it doesn't have a lot of political intensity on it. So if you want to enjoy exploring your own mind and your soul and enriching yourself, it's a good place to come. So do think about that. Now, Brooks Agnew's website, brooksagnew.com, if you go there, you can explore the work of a man with a remarkable and unique mind and a unique vision as well. And remembering the future, the physics of the soul, and time travel is empowering. That's the only way I can describe it, because what it does is, without belaboring the mathematics, it sees the world through the medium of the hidden powers and hidden energies that actually make things happen and make things work. Now, Brooks, I would like to go on to talk a little bit about, before we get into time, I have had many experiences of movement through time, personally. And in fact, my new book, Jesus, a New Vision, is in part due to the fact that I am able to see backwards in time, not forwards, but backwards. And therefore, what I can do is I can look back and then find in history and scholarship the exact points at which they were right, and then put that in my book. And I've done that. That's how this book was written. I did it a little bit in the past two books since I learned to do this. But what I found is, you can't change the past, but you can look at it. But that's not so true of the future, is it? You have a very different vision of the future.
Yeah, I do. And you can change the past within constraints. There are things.
Can you tell us about those constraints? Because since I can go there, I'd like to know how to do that.
Well, it's more not the actual event itself, but how we are affected by that event. One of the things I noticed when, sometimes you read books over and over again, like you read the Bible a lot.
That would be true in my case, certainly.
Yeah, you want to read the Bible a lot. And some people read it cover to cover, and some people just take a subject and then they go through the Bible by subject. But if you do it a number of times, the one thing anyone who does it notices is, every time you read it, even though it's the same words, the same Isaiah, the same Paul, the same Matthew, you get something new out of it. It's the past. And yet you are gaining some experience, some perspective, because maybe you're standing in a slightly different way when you go to the past and look at it this time. But I think it's more, you take your experience to the past over and over again. And with that experience, you see and hear new things. I spoke to a woman a couple of years ago, and she was held back in her progress. She was 50 years old. And I said, "What's holding you back?" And she said, "Well, my father was very strict, and I never finished the fourth grade. You know, I went on to the fifth grade and never learned the concepts in the fourth grade." I said, "But you're 50. How could not learning something in the fourth grade hold you back now? Why don't you just go back to the fourth grade and learn those things and then come back to the future, here, the present, and apply them?" So you can change the past with respect to how you are affected by the past. The future is a little bit different. Now, the future is created by you. Now, I don't mean the whole future, but a spot of it. You say, "I want to be this in the future." You're not it now, but you want to be that in the future. So, or have this. "I want to have this house," or "I want to move to Idaho," or "I want to start a farm." It's a future look, and you put that as crystal clear as you can, with all of the trimmings out there in a place in the future. And then you come back to the past, which is the present. Things in your present will begin resonating with that image that energy that you put in the future. That energy is going through time. just like your consciousness is going through time right now. And that's how we affect it. And of course, one person can have great effects, but a dozen or a thousand or a million people can change the universe.
Now that's fascinating. It reminds me of the intention effect. And can you expand on that a little bit?
Sure. When you apply intention, you are what I call polarizing or refining your frequency. It's not white noise anymore. It's, you know, a 443, or it's a C note. It's something very crisp and very focused, like a laser beam. Of course, a laser has way more power because it's just one frequency and all the wavelengths are lined up with one another. So it's a lot more intense. That's what intention is. Thinking about something is okay. Pondering on something is way more powerful.
Well, I'm tell you something that happened to me recently. I had learned back in the summer of 2019 to see into a parallel universe very clearly. My listeners know all about this, so I'm not going to go through it again. But I described the experience in my book, A New World. It happened at the Lakota Sioux Reservation while I was at a conference. I suddenly, when I closed my eyes, I saw another version of the same place and incredible detail. I could lean down and see the stones and the little grass and flowers and open my eyes, and it was different stones and grass and flowers. It was just, and it lasted all weekend. So I learned to do this with a type of concentration, which I would call full body concentration. Is this making sense? I bet it is. You're nodding your head. And I really did it. I learned to, there were certain places, it's not possible to do it everywhere, but there are certain places like at the edge of water or any kind of edge in the world that you can really look into this other universe. But something happened one day, a couple of weeks ago, right before Christmas. I was doing this. I was sitting on a bench in a park doing it, just total full body concentration, seeing this so vividly. And suddenly, my right eye blew out. And I've lost 40% of the vision in my right eye forever. The doctor said I have a condition called non-arthritic anterior ischemic optic neuropathy. I blew out my optic nerve doing this.
Wow.
Yeah. Fortunately, it didn't happen on both sides, so I can still see. But and my eyes will compensate. The doctor said it's not the end of the world. So, and it's not. I mean, I will compensate. I can still drive. It's not 3%. I misspoke myself. It's 20%. So, but here's the question. This is all real as far as I'm concerned. Now, where can we take this? Because can we take this to the future? Skills like this.
And you could even bring it back from the future. That's one of the great things about resonance theory and about building resonant energy. What I found is the same thing that appeared in the Fibonacci process, that these eight iterations or eight repeats or eight cycles have great power. I interviewed professional golfers and I asked them, how many pro-ams did you play before you went pro? Before you thought, hey, I'm in the zone. Every ball I hit is going to go right where I want it to go and way further than anyone else on the course. It was eight. And then I asked real estate.
It was how many?
It was eight.
Eight.
Eight pro-ams they played and they went pro. And then I asked real estate salesmen who are pretty successful. They make about $1 million a quarter. They're very successful. And I asked them, you know, when you first started out, how many closings did you do before you thought, hey, I could do this, and you quit your job and you became a full-time real estate salesman. It was eight. And I asked professional baseball players, how many times did you try to come out of the minors before you went pro? Eight. It was incredible. These people were in the zone, and it was because they had learned the resonance, the constructive interference of their sport, of their profession, and they used it, used these mathematical principles without even knowing about them. But everybody can't be a pro baseball player or a successful real estate salesman or a professional golfer. That's
what I might miss professional guy. I am a failed golfer, but then again, I went to a sports medicine doctor and said to him, you know, my game just has been ruined. I had got a bad knee, not from golf exactly, but from other things. And I got the knee fixed, and I said, you know, I tried playing and my golf game is terrible. And I'm just wondering if you could take a look at my swing and see if there's something that is still impeding it. And he said, well, Whitley, you know, you're talking about golf, and I'm a sports medicine doctor, not a psychiatrist. Which I thought, boy, he's a good golfer and he knows. But why eight?
Eight is this the number of iterations it takes to reach that golden mean, to get the airplane up off the runway to where you're in this instantaneous rate of change, we call it. It's a slope of increase of energy where you overcome what we call the second law of thermodynamics, or entropy, where, you know, basically things rot or they fall apart or they go back to dust. But if you reach this zone, you can put in very little energy and get magnificent results. Well, what we want to do is use that to make the future that we put out there become manifest. And it works. It works very well. I've been doing it for a long time myself, and I teach other people how to do it. And it's having remarkable effects on moving them out of their doldrum or fixing their cycle of failure in their life.
So, in other words, you have courses and you teach things. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. I based it on the book, Remembering the Future. And my avatar or my target market is a person, say, 45 to 55 years old. Their kids are grown and gone. They've already done everything they have to. And now it's time again to do what they want to. And many people, believe it or not, have lost that dream. They lost their way. Their 401k is small, too small to retire at 45 or 55, and they really don't know what to do. They don't have a purpose in their life. And so I'm good at helping them find that dream again and then place that dream out there in the future. And I give them the tools and journaling and teach them how to gather up the energy from their iterations to make that future happen. And it works with everything. And it works for good, and it also works for ill. That's why you see everything you see every single day on the news or on TV. They're pouring their version of the future at you so that you will use your energy and whatever your reaction to it is to make their future manifest. But you could see that their future is imaginary, that their future is, shall we say, fairy tale. And yet it keeps moving forward because millions and millions of people are putting their attention on it. And what you need to learn to do is how to put attention on what you want to do.
I get it. And you can teach that.
Sure.
Because, you know, let's talk a little bit about the attention, because the attention is so powerful. My whole relationship with the visitors, which is at this point in my life, a big, complex, wonderful, and very, at times, dangerous relationship. I mean, obviously, they were telling me not to fool with the parallel universe, and I blew my eye out doing it. But, you know, that's my fault. I was warned. And but I don't stop. And you know, maybe that's one of the reasons I'm here. But what about that? What about the use of attention as a tool?
Well, it works two ways. One is, of course, you can be distracted. And sometimes we want to be. Sometimes we want to go party. We want to go play and do nothing in particular. I ride a motorcycle, and sometimes people ask me, where are you going today? And the answer is pretty much always the same. No particular place. The idea behind that is kind of Zen. It goes back to a teaching that the Buddha had centuries ago. And that is that it is the path that is just as important as the destination. For instance, when you go to the beach to build a sandcastle, you might take your bucket and your shovel, and the idea is to be on the beach building a sandcastle. Because when the sandcastle's finished, you're kind of let down. I'm going to walk away from it. I'm going to step on it. I'm going to let the waves take it back. That wasn't the goal at all. The goal was to be building the sandcastle. So attention is something that we are in control of. We don't think we are, because we get distracted so easily because of the carnival of life.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's concentration, isn't it?
And you see people, you know, what are they doing all day? Exactly what Aldous Huxley said we would be doing all day. Looking at our screen. We'd have our head down and not paying any attention to the real world. And
yeah, and it's horrible with the kids. My children have a tremendous battle with their children trying to prevent them becoming screen addicts, and it's a losing battle.
And what's their attention span? 9 seconds?
Yeah, exactly. You know, because they've been cooped up for so long, there's just no controlling it. And I think that one of the things that's happening is a plague of damaged attention spans because of the COVID epidemic.
No doubt about it.
Yeah, no doubt about that.
The idea of sitting down and reading a book for an hour and a half is so foreign to this generation.
It blew
my mind.
I know it's frightening. It wasn't. I know kids who used to read voraciously and don't anymore, and they're all on their screens all the time. And
the interesting thing about reading is very much like your vision. You're just looking at paper pages with images of letters on them, but you're seeing flying machines and dinosaurs and 20,000 leagues under the sea. Your imagination is stimulated by the words that you're reading. And that is very healthy for the mind. It's very healthy for communication, for your emotional strength, for your ability to express yourself. My kids used to read R.L. Stine, the books, Goosebumps. It's a company that put out a book a week or something like that for years. And it was all, you know, goblins and ghosts and mystery, kind of like, you know.
It was fun. It was fun stuff.
Like Nancy Drew or Hardy Boys or something like that.
Right.
But I didn't care because the kids were reading, and it helped them through their whole life that they were able to read and turn those words into images.
Yeah. And and that process is so strengthening to the attention and the mind. It makes you powerful. Whereas sending your attention out to a screen diminishes it. And is that a kind of conspiracy somewhere in there? I mean, I can't tell, but it's as if the world is being somehow put to sleep.
We're being attenuated because our version of the future might be, you know, quite fantastic, but it's not the same version as the people who are controlling the world right now. And so what they want to do is dumb down our ability to create a future so that their version of the future is the only one on the menu.
What worries me is I see ultra wealthy people buying land in isolated places and building compounds that are fully stocked on the one hand. On the other hand, spitting out stuff about how climate change isn't real and so on and so forth. Is there a depopulation conspiracy going on, do you think?
Oh, I don't know about that. I mean, it's depopulation is something that occurs naturally, either from cataclysms of one kind or another, pandemics of one kind or another.
Yeah.
I mean, nobody really seriously believes that the Earth is going to go back to having 500 million people on it because we would be tribal again. We'd be hunter-gatherers. There would be.
Yeah, we sure would.
There wouldn't be anybody to make cars or airplanes or robots or man the internet, or there wouldn't be any of that.
You'd
be,
and they would all become very mysterious and eventually rust away. And here we would be again, starting all over from the beginning. You know,
as well as I do that there are individuals who know a lot more about this than I do. There have been other zeniths of humanity on this world before, hundreds of thousands, millions of years ago, but they're gone. And all the people that knew how to do stuff are gone. And we started over somehow.
Well, you know, I found out when I was writing my book about Jesus that the resurrection, for example, had happened.
Yeah.
And we know a lot about the energy that was involved, that this is material that is absolutely not in the public space at all. But what we don't know, but probably could know if we would look at it carefully enough, is how when he turned into energy, he turned into light energy, became a man of light in that tomb. And in my book, you can see it's clear as day. It happened. How did he become a man of light and not just a mass of light? In other words, how did he walk again? But somebody knew, because if you read the Gospels like a detective and maybe have a little help of being able to look back in time, you can find that there is a group of people who were working with him from the beginning, who were almost invisible in the Gospels. If you look carefully, they're there. They knew what they were doing. He knew what he was doing. And we've lost that. We've lost that knowledge. That was knowledge from a higher level, from a distant past, that we have lost.
Yeah, even the writers that years later tried to, you know, write an epistle or a gospel about it, they did their own investigation, you know, trying to remember things and write things down. And even that was edited over the centuries.
Over the centuries, yeah. But if you go back and you look at what really happened, you can figure out the distortions that the edit that came into it and reconsider it, rebuild it. And that's why the book's called A New Vision. But listen, I'm not talking about my book. There's a strange, it's not strange. I mean, there's a confluence between the two things here.
Sure.
I want to talk now and to go into the biology. You mentioned Bruce Lipton's book, The Biology of Belief, which I thought was a fascinating passage. You say, Bruce Lipton told me personally of an electromagnetic image of the creature that serves as the extra-dimensional pattern by which the physical cells simply fulfill like a paint-by-numbers model. Now, we're going to get into that in a few minutes. But I want to remind you all now that Brooks's website is brooksagnew.com. The book we're talking about is his book, Remembering the Future. It's a great book. It's not huge, and it's very accessible. You're going to get a lot out of it, and you can engage with Brooks on his website, too. There's a lot of engagement there. There's a store, but there's other ways of engaging with him and gaining his wisdom on that from that website and from direct contact. You have courses, and I believe
they're face to face and they're live. So once a month I have a Saturday, two Saturdays in a row actually. There's class one and class two once a month, and we teach these principles. And it's one on one, or sometimes there are 40 people in the class, but I take questions and apply these principles directly to your life condition.
So it's well worth exploring, I think. Or obviously, Bruce wouldn't be here. and you're also going to be at the Contact in the Desert conference. I think it's going to be virtual this year. And are you going to be anywhere else? Any other conferences?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I was completely booked in 2020 and everything evaporated after January. So Victoria and I are trying to put together this Contact in the Desert in Palm Springs. We don't know if it's going to happen or not. We don't know what the state of California is going to do.
Yeah. Victoria is the head of Contact in the Desert. She's talking to all of us. She's called me about whether or not to go virtual and
it's so difficult
forth.
To do. I mean, the live experience, there's nothing like it. And this is the biggest UFO conference in the world.
Yeah, I know. And I told her that if there's any possibility of doing it, we should do it rather than go virtual.
Yeah.
Consciousness and Contact, which is another big one this in February, has no choice but to go virtual. So they're going to be virtual. Anyway, that aside, Dr. Lipton's, Bruce Lipton was the author of The Biology of Belief, and he told me personally of an electromagnetic image of the creature that serves as the extra dimensional pattern by which the physical cells simply fulfill like a paint by numbers model. Now, a lot of people talk about the second body or the electromagnetic body. Is that what this is?
Well, we have that, sort of an energy body in which our physical biological transducer sits right now. We can connect it with mudras and we can photograph it. But I was having the discussion with Bruce or Dr. Lipton about, how a cell, when it dies, how does the cell next to it know to differentiate, like to become eye tissue or a bone or skin or something like that? Because it's all the same genetics. They could take a genetic swab of the inside of your cheek and tell everything about you. You've done it with 23andMe. And he said, well, they just take the information of the cell next to it and use it to duplicate itself. And I said, well, what if the cells are like right next to each other? Like you're talking about tendon and muscle, different kind of protein structure. How does that cell know whether to become tendon or whether to become muscle? And he got a little bit more cagey with me. He said, well, it's sometimes it becomes tendon and sometimes it becomes muscle. I said, all right, well, let's take this to the basics. Let's say there are only two cells. There's just the egg and the sperm. How do they know what to become? There is no cell next to the other cell. They only got half the DNA, both cells that come together. He said, well, and this wasn't in his book. He said, I got to tell you, Brooks, what we think is that there's an electromagnetic image of the fetus. And as the cells begin dividing in the physical world, all they're doing is filling in, like paint by numbers, filling in that electromagnetic image of the fetus. And I said, that is very profound.
That's yeah, I should awesome. Say so.
Somehow when that woman conceives, or at the moment of energetic conception, the image of that fetus is inside the woman, even if it's small. And then it grows and fills in with actual cells. They actually have an electromagnetic pattern to go by to make that body.
Now, where does that pattern come from?
Well,
are we talking about reincarnation here?
Well, no, I don't think it's reincarnation, because we are actually creating life in our own image. So this is the creation process that we have very humbly been given the opportunity to participate in a small way. And it should be revered like that. And what breaks my heart sometimes is to think that every year on this planet, we kill almost 43 million fetuses.
Yeah. It is a great tragedy. And, you know, way back in the early days in the Didache, which is the first guide, as it were, for Christians to how they should live, it mentions that not killing the unborn or the born, because in those days it was perfectly legal if a baby came and you didn't like it, didn't want it for some reason, you could just leave it on a street corner to die. We've gone beyond that. And once a life starts, stopping it unless absolutely necessary, unless it's not working, and you know, in other words, there's something wrong with the fetus or something like that, serious, I don't see where we can do that. And yet at the same time, I mean, when a young woman is knocked up or raped and a baby starts to come, those are hard decisions, but I don't want to get into that. That's not what we're here to talk about, for goodness sakes.
Yeah, the point is that I discovered through my own past trips, I guess, back to the days of the ancient teachers, Jesus and others, that mortality is actually a very valuable condition of the soul. It's a place where we are able to slow time down. Because I was interviewing a friend of mine, Dr. Ed Close, and he wrote this great book called Transcendental Physics. And we were discussing the photon as it leaves the star Arcturus and goes however 8 light years through space, avoiding all kinds of obstacles to reach Earth, and then hits the rods and cones in my eye, and I can say, oh, wow, there's Arcturus. And he said, well, yes, that's from your perspective. But from the photon's perspective, leaving Arcturus, there's no path from the star to Earth. I said, how can that be? I mean, he said, well, it's like a baseball pitcher, you know, throwing the ball so fast that it leaves the pitcher's hand and appears in the catcher's glove instantaneously. There's no path. And I admitted that's what happens when I play baseball, but that there is a path. And he said, well, think of the equation. E is equal to mc squared. I said, okay. So at the speed of light, what happens to mass? I said, well, it approaches infinity, obviously. He said, exactly. Which means distance actually becomes zero in space. I said, so you're telling me that from the perspective of the photon, if I'm on my photon rocket ship, the Big Bang never happened. The entire universe is still the singularity. And it's our consciousness that's been able to slow the universe down so we can behold it. It was a pretty profound epiphany. He wrote a second book because of that. And I think we've lost that. We think that mortality is some kind of curse that we've been cast out of heaven.
Yeah.
We earned the right to come here.
That's my feeling exactly. I just have that instinctively, deeply in me.
Yeah, we have the state. We're not being punished. We're being rewarded for our faith in the pre-existence.
Yeah, and you can do a good job here or a bad job here too. So, you know, what is a good job?
Well, getting through life without hurting anybody. But I think Jesus was a great teacher in this because, and people miss this. I think it's more important to learn how to love everyone without having an expectation of being loved.
That's even so true.
Had enemies. Jesus had enemies, but he still loved everybody.
And yeah, Anne's byword was always have joy. And that's how you do it. Joy does not have expectations. If you drop away all of the expectations, what you have is this beautiful body sailing through time, and it feels good, and it's a wonderful experience, and it's going to come to an end. And that's fine too. That's the way it's supposed to be. If you weren't moving through time, you would not have experience. You would be watching from the outside.
Yeah, and you know, we realize that this coupling of an eternal being with a mortal being is very valuable. It's so valuable, especially on this planet. You know, the best souls in the universe came here for a mortal life.
Right.
Great gift to be born on this planet. We could have been born on other worlds, which are not nearly as spontaneously living as this one.
Did you know anything about other worlds? Because I'd be fascinated if you do.
In the book,
I don't know much about physical worlds.
There's
go ahead.
A chapter on that in Remembering the Future, because one of the things I realized in meditation is that I kept waking up in a different place. I knew it was different because when I looked up, I could see a red giant sun. It was expanding. The corona had already gone red. And through the corona of the sun, because it was kind of a pale red in space, I could see two other suns, two other stars, a blue one and a red one. So I knew I was on another world. And one day, this was maybe years into this meditation, because I'm looking at it from inside my eyes. I'm taking in the whole world there. I've been there many, many times. I resolved that I was going to see what I look like. So I looked down at my hand and I recorded my hand. And then I came back and I drew it and I put it in the book. It has six fingers and it has four joints to the fingers, not three. So I drew the hand. It's in the book.
Yeah, it's in here and I'm looking for it. I'd like to hold it up.
Sure.
I'm not seeing it.
It's in the, I don't know, the first 18 pages or something like that. It's
Yeah, I remember it well.
That's actually my hand. I drew it from memory. I'm not a really great artist, but it looks pretty good.
Yeah. Okay, folks, I'm going to hold it up. This is the hand. Yeah, that he drew. Okay.
So that's why I realized
seven fingers, six fingers and a thumb. That would be an interesting thing to work with.
Well, it's five fingers and a thumb. You can count them, but
I did. I miscounted them. Well, my eyes. I'm working on 1, 2, 3, 4, five fingers and a thumb. Yeah, six. That's right.
I'm in a different body on a different world, and there are different people living there. This was
clearly
years before Avatar the movie came out. So it's you'll find it fascinating, and I actually took it out of the book, and before I released the first edition, the book was kind of small. It was very deep as far as the principles, but it didn't really have a story to it.
Right.
At the last minute, because I'm a professional engineer, and sometimes publishing things will have adverse effects on your ability to find work. I decided the last minute, what the heck? I'm just going to put it in there. So I did. And the book has been a top seller. And I can't tell you the emails I have gotten on this book from people that have read that and said, I am so glad you put that in there, because I've always felt like I had another world of experience inside me, but people thought I was crazy.
Yeah. We're coming to the end of the first hour of the show. And our free Dreamlanders will be leaving us, sadly. And the way to not do that anymore is simple. Go to unknowncountry.com and subscribe. And go to brooksagnew.com and learn and explore and try his course. It sounds wonderful to me. And a great foundation, a great place to start is remembering the future. So do that. And Brooks, in the second or third half hour of the show, I want to talk about other worlds and those deep, incredible journeys that you've taken, and also to touch on what you think is most important for our viewers and listeners to know, because this is the part of the show where people who are really serious about this are listening and watching and absorbing every single word Free Dreamlanders, thank you as always for being with us, and we will see you again next week.
You've been listening to Dreamland. Be sure to tune in again next week. Dreamland is brought to you by UnknownCountry.com and its family of subscribers. Our theme music is The O of Pleasure by Ray Lynch. Unknown Country was founded by Ann Streber. Our news editor is Matthew Frizzell. Our coordinator is Amy Safrankova. Whitley Streber is your Dreamland host. And I'm your announcer, Ted Alexander.